Good afternoon. Last time, we talked about exceptions, which were this hardware mechanism for control flow that wasn't jump and call and so on. And we mentioned that these were used for a whole wide variety of things. We had events external to the program, like we had timers, we had used to stop programs from running forever, we had I.O., we had things that were deliberately triggered by a program. We had these system calls because we learned that in order to ask the OS to do something, we can't just make a function call because the OS runs with special privileges. We had faults for something went wrong and it's possibly recoverable. So you mentioned out-of-bounds memory accesses, divided by zeros, and so on. Now, you might say, none of these sound recoverable. We'll hopefully get to one example today about why we have this as a separate category from our last of aborts, which are for things like, oh, main memory was broken. Things that we can't recover from. We learned that, well, we have these exceptions that are jumping somewhere, so we have this table of exception handlers written by the OS. The processor reads a table entry and sets the program counter to that address. And tied to exceptions was this idea of kernel and user mode, that there's some things we only want the OS to do. And part of that has to do with exceptions, because we wanted the OS to be able to run a program for a while and then stop it with this timer. But if a program could just change the configuration of the timer or change the configuration of the exception handlers, then that wouldn't work. So we have this set of privileged instructions that are only allowed in kernel mode, and the OS gets to run in kernel mode. But we have to have some way of running the OS then, and exceptions are exactly that way. So whenever an exception happens, we always run the exception handler in kernel mode. And when the exception handler is done, it can return back into user mode to run a user application without giving it extra privileges to do things that we don't want every program to be able to do. And because user code now can't do everything that's possible on the machine, it needs some way to request services. Services like, I want to read from a file, but I can't do that directly. So we have these system calls to request operations that only kernel mode can do, which was just a type of exception the program would deliberately trigger. So mentioned that in our exception handlers, we had this sort of procedure about what we need to do, which was a little different than what we saw with normal function calls. So with normal function calls, we could rely on that the act of making the call saved where we should return to. Here, we're relying on the processor having special support for that. There's not going to be an instruction which says to do it. The processor needs to have logic that's going to save the program counter before it overwrites it with something else. And the handler is then going to need to save any additional registers it cares about. We can't rely on the idea of caller save registers we're used to from the calling convention, because our exceptions could happen at any time in the case of things like a timer interrupt. And then we mentioned, well, after it's done, it gets to return. And for something like a system call, we imagine, we do some work, then we go back to the program. But we don't have to do that. We can return to something else. And this was really useful, because, well, sometimes we don't want to keep running the program. We had the example of a timer interrupt. We say, well, you've run for long enough. I want to run something else. How do you run something else? We load the state of another program and return to where the other program was. Or we might say, you're asking to read from the keyboard. Well, that means I'm going to run something else that wants to actually use the computer right now. So we'll return to that other thing which wants to run until someone actually presses a key on the keyboard. And this gave us the idea of a context switch, that we store the context, the saved state of a program, and restore some other program in order to switch what we called a process was running. Questions? Yeah. So we talked about this notion of a process. So with a process, we had this illusion. We had a CPU to ourselves and memory to ourselves. And together, that gave us this abstraction known as a process. And we used context switching to create the illusion that you had your own CPU, this thread of control that ran. And today, we're going to talk about how we're going to create the illusion of memory in more detail. We spent some time talking about, well, if we have these different sort of illusory CPUs, how do we reason about what's going to happen when we have two things executing, as we know, concurrently, not literally at the same time, if we have only one core, but interleaved with each other, and it turned out interleaved with each other in a way where the operating system could make any choice at once as far as what gets to run when. So to reason about what happened, we have this idea of a graph where we drew things we knew happened before the other, and that let us figure out what could possibly happen. We saw a bunch of examples of that with fork, but the idea is more general and for any other time where we have two things running concurrently. And mentioning fork, we gave some examples of, well, if we have this idea of a process, we have to have some way of creating them. So we gave example of the fork system call is the traditional Unix way of making a new process. There's also, of course, some other system calls that we didn't have time to get to that you'll learn more about if you take operating systems. Like one, we need, if we can create a process, we need to wait for a process to finish. So there's a wait system call in Unix-like OSs. And perhaps most importantly, you usually imagine creating a new process runs a different program. We need a mechanism for running different programs. And the Unix one is there's something called exec, which loads, I have this inverted, loads into the current process a new program. And you might say, that seems like a weird choice. Why don't we just have a sort of fork and load a different process? It is a weird choice, but it is what they decided to do. So when you type ls in your shell forks a copy of the shell and then runs this thing to load ls into that copy. In the traditional Unix way. There's other options for this, which maybe would be used in some systems. Okay, so questions about anything with processes or exceptions? We get to our main topic for today. All good about it. Okay, so when we talked about exceptions, we used terms like interrupt, trap, and so on. And unfortunately, the real world is very inconsistent about this. So like our textbook has very precise terms which mean exactly one thing. Unfortunately, if you just pick up like an Intel manual or an ARM manual or like an IBM manual, you probably will get like three or more different versions of what the term interrupt and trap and exception mean exactly. So for example, our textbook uses exception to mean all kinds of exceptions that use this hardware mechanism. Some processor manuals use the word exception to mean only things that are faults. They call the other types of exceptions with a different name. And sometimes interrupts, like in our textbook, means asynchronous events only. And sometimes, like in the Intel manuals, it means all of them, all the types of exceptions. So this is a mess, but I'm telling you not because we're going to like have you figure out, remember all the different versions, but because if you actually like pick up a processor manual or a textbook or something like that, you should realize you need to check the definitions and look for context clues to figure out what do they actually mean by interrupt. Okay. So our main topic of today is going to be talking about the memory part of processes. And we mentioned last time that each process kind of has the same memory layout, and we're going to make that happen by doing what we know as address translation, that there's going to be some real addresses that the program's using that are different than the ones the program thinks it's using. And there's going to be some mapping between them. So we have our program layout that looks, you know, kind of the same for every program, but we're actually going to load all of our programs that are running, which all have a layout that looks like this, at different locations in memory. So to make that happen, we're going to have this idea that each process is going to have its own mapping from the addresses it uses to the real memory addresses. And the operating system is going to be able to configure that mapping in a way that it chooses. And as part of doing the context switch, it's going to change what mapping is active based on whether we want to run process A or B. Questions about this high-level idea? Mapping. So you're saying, so a question is, why would we want to have all programs have the same layout?
Right.
So one reason why is that we'd like to be able to, if we have multiple copies of the same program, to load them at the same time and not have to change memory addresses that are like embedded in the executable. So like the executable has some memory addresses inside it. We'd like to not have to edit those each time we run a new copy of, say, the program. So like, for example, on a department machine, maybe there's like 15 copies of Emacs running. We'd like to have them all loaded at the same time, even though they might have in their assembly the address of a global variable somewhere. Okay. So we're going to talk about how this mapping works, and we're going to talk about the most common current implementation of this mapping. First, I'm going to start with some terminology. So we're going to call the addresses that a process accesses, the ones that it thinks it's using, virtual addresses. And these include every address the program uses, no exceptions. And what people most commonly forget in there is that a program accesses memory to load instructions. When we set RPC, that's a virtual address. It goes through this translation, just like if I do an MR move queue, it's going to go through this translation. Every single of the address the program knows about, if the program's not the OS, it doesn't know what any of the real addresses are. And we're going to call these addresses the program knows about virtual addresses. And they're going to turn into physical addresses. That's the term we're going to use for the real addresses that happen after this mapping. And because we have this mapping in between our virtual and physical addresses, it's not necessarily going to be the case that the addresses are the same size. So we can have our virtual addresses be larger or smaller than our physical addresses, and that's fine because we have this mapping in between to add or remove the bits. And our big decision is, well, where is this mapping stored? So we're going to talk about that today. And what format does it take? So I'm going to start with a toy example. So here I'm going to have a program where I have 10-bit virtual addresses. So I have 2 to the 10 bytes of memory the program can access. And I'm going to divide it up into 4 equally sized pieces. And let's say, you know, we're going to use the bottom piece for the code, the next piece for its data and the heap, and the last piece for its stack. And we also have some room for either more heap, or it's probably going to be initially empty when we haven't needed to malloc memory yet. And I'm going to call each of these equally sized pieces a virtual page. Now, a convenient choice I've made here is that my pages are just 2 to the 8 bytes, 256 byte sections of memory. So I've just divided up the memory the program may access into these power of 2 size pieces. And because I chose a power of 2 size, that means that this number for the pages, I started 0, 1, 2, 3, that number is just the top few bits of the address. That's deliberate. That's because I chose a power of 2 size. And when we're going to use these units of pages, that's going to be really convenient in our hardware, because now we can really quickly figure out which page does this address belong to. And we'll call this part of the address the virtual page number. So number of the page, numbered starting with 0. Now, the rest of the address, we can think of as telling us where in the page a particular byte is. So at 300, I have an address at the beginning of this page. At 3FF, I have one at the end. So the remaining bits tell us whether we're at the beginning, all zeros, or the end of the page. And we'll call that the page offset. So I have this way of dividing up the addresses the program uses. Now I'm going to use that to construct my mapping. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take my physical addresses, and I'm going to divide them up in the same way. Divide them up into equal size pages. And because I divided them up into equal size pages, and equal size was a power of 2, just like with the virtual addresses, I can get the number of the page by looking at the first few bits of the physical address. And I'm just going to say that a whole virtual page is stored in a whole one of these physical pages. So I'm just going to decide arbitrarily that each virtual page goes to some physical page. And I'm going to write down what that mapping looks like in a table. Because, well, I can draw this, but probably it's going to be hard for me to show my processor a drawing and have it figure out what to do. This table is getting a lot closer to something our processor could just directly handle. So here I've said virtual page 0. This first one here maps to physical page 010, that's 2, which is here. And so on. Note that I also have a page that I didn't allocate anything for. The one we marked as empty, I just have that labeled none. So this table we call a page table. And we can turn this into something we can now use to actually implement this mapping. So first, we need to actually store this table in a way the CPU can understand. You may notice this looks really similar to how we were storing things in caches. We have rows, which are our what we call page table entries. But I needed some way of representing that none. And just like with caches, where I needed some way of saying this cache entry doesn't have anything in it, we're going to add a valid bit. So that's what I use to represent our none. And here's our table. We have our indexes, which, like in our cache, we had our set index. Here our indexes are what virtual page number am I looking up. So we don't actually have to store that, but that's how we know which row is which. And when the program tries to access some memory, our processor is going to need to look at that address. And first, it's going to split it up into pieces. So I need to extract the virtual page number to figure out what row of this table do I actually want to access? And we're going to look at that row of the table. And we're going to extract everything in there. So we have this valid bit, and we need to figure out what do we do if the valid bit isn't set. So with a cache, we like retrieve the data from memory. That's not an option here. If the valid bit isn't set, there's no mapping whatsoever. And what we're going to do in that case is we're going to trigger an exception. We're going to tell the OS, hey, the program accessed memory that doesn't map to anything. What do you want to do? And maybe the OS will decide to do something like kill the program and print segmentation faults. And we also have this physical page number. So if it is valid, we're going to take this physical page number and use that in conjunction with the page offset from the original address, because if we accessed an address at the beginning of the virtual page, it should map to an address at the beginning of the corresponding physical page. And if it's near the end, it should map to something near the end. So we just keep the page offset unchanged. And that's our physical address. And that's what our cache is going to deal with. And we're just going to send that onto the cache and continue on with the program. So some terminology. So each of the entries in this table we call a page table entry. We have our virtual page number that we started with, which maps to a physical page number. And the rest we call the page offset. We don't distinguish between virtual and physical because it's the same no matter which version of the address you have. So questions about this procedure? Yeah.
If you have a different number of virtual and physical pages, is the page offset still the same size?
The question is, if I have a different number of virtual and physical pages, is the page offset still the same size? So the page offset size depends on how big our pages are. So that's the number which matters. So if you have a different number of virtual pages because you kept the same page size but just added more bits to the address, then no. But if you have a different number of virtual pages because you decided to change the page size, then yes. And note that it has to be the same between the virtual and physical, so the page size for both has to be the same. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So we have these page tables, and switching that page table is going to be part of our context switch now. So we're just going to set what page table the processor is using. That's going to be an extra privileged instruction that can only run in kernel mode that's part of our context switch to make that happen. Now, an issue with this is if we think about an exception happening, we didn't talk about the exception doing anything to this mapping. And in fact, on most processors, it doesn't. That the exception just jumps to a particular address and goes to kernel mode. But that gives us a problem, because that address it jumps to has to contain code that does the switching, and that code must run in kernel mode because it's a privileged instruction, and it must be accessible because it's part of the page table. So one question is, what's preventing me from writing a program that actually edits that? Because if I modify that code, that's real bad. And when Daniel Graham talked last time, he mentioned that we're going to just reserve a part of our memory for the kernel, typically at the higher addresses. And our page tables are going to give us the actual mechanism we do that. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to add an extra field to each page table entry saying that this address can only be accessed in kernel mode. Or we might alternately say this address can be accessed in user mode. It means the same thing. And we're going to check this as part of our accesses. So we're going to do our same lookup, but in addition to retrieving a valid bit, we're going to retrieve this kernel-only bit, and we're going to trigger an exception in the case where we have that kernel-only bit set and we're in user mode. And now we can use one of these virtual pages that we've marked as kernel only as the place where we store that switching code, where we have our exception handlers, and now the program can't edit our exception handlers, but they still have a memory address. Some questions? This idea? The question is, does this mean that the kernel code is replicated across all the page tables, or is it just all pointing to the same place? So it's all pointing to the same place, but we're going to have multiple copies of the pointers, the page table entries that point to it. Okay. So in our toy example, I had these 10-bit virtual addresses. You might say, OK, that's not how things really work. And you might say, OK, I have 64-bit pointers, therefore I have 64-bit virtual addresses. And that makes a lot of sense, because based on what we've been looking at, that must be what happens. But sometimes part of the pointer is not used. So for example, on 64-bit Linux, only 48 bits of the pointer is used. There's just some bits that they decided, we're not going to use these bits. They require them to have a fixed value, but other than that, they're just not used. We don't figure in the lookin. And when we talk about the virtual address size, we usually mean the size that's actually used. So we'll say we have 48-bit virtual addresses, even though the pointers are 64 bits, because there's 48 bits which matter for the mapping. And sometimes we're going to talk about the size of an address space. And by the size of an address space, we mean the amount of stuff you can make up addresses for based on the number of unique addresses. So for example, with a 32-bit virtual address, that's a 2 to the 32-byte virtual address space. With a 20-bit physical address, that's a 2 to the 20-byte physical address space. But this doesn't mean that there's actually 2 to the 20 different things or 2 to the 32 different things that you can usefully use. To give a concrete example, if I have a machine with 3 gigs of memory, I don't have a 3 gig address space because I can't have a 31.5-byte pointer. You know, that's just not physically possible. So what's happening is that there's some physical addresses which just aren't useful. But our address space is still a power of 2 size. And this is like really common because usually you don't have the maximum possible amount of memory in your CPU. Okay. So speaking of virtual and physical addresses, so let's say I have 32-bit addresses and 2 to the 12 byte, 4,096 byte pages. How many virtual pages does this system have? Yeah. 2 to the 20. So how did you get that?
So each page is 2 to the 12. Well, I mean, it's just 2 to the 12 times 2 to the 20 is like 2 to the 32.
Yeah, so you said, 2 to the 32 bytes by 2 to the 12 bytes a page equals 2 to the 20 pages. Exactly. Okay. And okay, which is what I have. So let's say we have that. So I have my 2 to the 20 virtual pages here. The virtual pages. And let's say I have 30-bit physical addresses. And my page table entries have a physical page number, a valid bit, and a kernel mode bit. So given how we've seen page tables looking like, how big is the page table? Yeah. So 2 to the... So you're saying 2 to the 22, what's the units?
Sorry,
2 to the 14. 2 to the 14 what?
2 to the 22, because you need, because there's 2 to the 22 possible pages plus a page for the valid internal
business. Okay, so you're saying 2 to the 22 pages, we have 2 to the 20 off by, I think there's 2 to the 20 virtual pages. You think that's what matters? Or?
It's the page number of the virtual pages you have to keep track
of. So, sorry?
Isn't it the page number on the virtual pages that you have
to... So that's the number of entries we have. So it should be 2 to the 20 entries.
Times.
You said a valid bit, a kernel bit. So it's 2 to the 20 entries, but we need to know how big is each entry. So we have 2 to the 20 entries, which is 1 for each virtual page. 1 per virtual page. And they each have at least a valid and a kernel bit plus the physical page number. So this is 1 bit for the valid bit, 1 bit for the kernel mode bit. How big is the physical page number? So one way of thinking about this is that if we think of our physical address, we can divide it up into a page offset and our physical page number. So if we figure out how big the page offset is, we know how big the physical address is, so we can do some subtraction and get the rest. So we know this overall is 30. So if we knew how big the page offset was, we could figure out the size of the physical page number. For how big the page offset is, we know there's 2 to the 12 bytes per page. The page offset tells us which byte it's referring to. So we must need 12 bits to determine which of those bytes. So we have 12 bits here, which means that this must be, for our physical addresses, 18. So we have 18 bits for our physical page number. So this means we have 2 to the 20 times 18 plus 1 plus 1 bit. Or 2 to the 20 times, this is 2.5 bytes. And this ends up being like about 2.5 megabytes. Questions about how I did that calculation? People look confused, and I don't know why. Yeah. I got 18. So each page is 2 to the 12 bytes. So that means that I need 12 bits to determine where in a page I am. So if I think of one page, I have 2 to the 12 possible addresses, so 12 bits to write that down. So that's the lower bits of my physical address. And I know we have 30 bits in my physical address in total, so the remaining bits must be the physical page number. And if 12 of the 30 bits are for the page offset, there's 18 remaining bits for the physical page number. And that's one of the things that's in my table, so that's how I got the 18. That answer question? Other questions? Yeah. Question is, doesn't that mean there's 2 to the 18 physical pages? Yes. Is your complaint, why is that smaller than the number of virtual pages? So this is fine, because not all of our virtual pages will be valid in the page table. Okay, other questions? Yeah. Here? That's a plus. It's 18 bits plus 1 bit plus 1 bit in each page table entry. Sorry, my handwriting. Okay. So if we're thinking of where we're storing this 2.5 meg page table, you might say, gosh, that's pretty big compared to what I've been thinking of storing in processors. We think of our L1 cache, this size is huge compared to anything we've talked about as a reasonable L1 cache size. So we're going to have a question we're going to get to later about where do we actually put this? Because putting it in the processor seems problematic if we can't put a 2 meg cache in our processor. But first, another exercise. So let's say I have this 4K pages. Here's an address. Split it into the page number and the page offset. Tell me, how should I go about this? What's the first thing I should figure out? Yeah. Okay, so you're saying this is the page offset, everything else is the page number. So how do we know that 6, 7, 8 is the page offset? So because this is exactly the bottom 12 bits. It happened to be split up evenly with hex. If I had inconveniently chosen like a page size of like 2 to the 13, then we'd have to like subdivide the hex digits. Okay. So we had these giant page tables. So where are we going to store them? And the answer is going to be, well, we're just going to put them in memory. We can't fit them on the processor conveniently, so we'll just write them in memory. Now, to do that, we need to decide how this corresponds to some bytes in memory. So here, I've decided that each of my page table entries I'm going to represent as a 16-bit integer. I'm just going to divide up the bits of that 16-bit integer into the fields we've seen before. So I'm going to say one of the bits, the most significant bit in this case, I've just arbitrarily chosen to be the valid bit, then the kernel bit, then our physical page number, and then I have some leftover bits because I'm keeping things a whole number of bytes. I'm just not going to use them. And we're going to store an array of these entries in memory. So this is just an array of, in this case, 16-bit numbers. And what we're going to tell the processor is, where does this array start? So there's going to be a special register that tells it what the base address of the page table is. And instead of the processor looking up a row in the table directly, it's going to use that base address and add the virtual page number times the size of each entry to go to the right index of that array and read that from memory and interpret it based on this table. So we'll have a pointer to some bytes of memory, and we want to figure out, well, what's the page table entry for virtual page 0? Well, it has a valid bit of 0, a kernel bit of 0, page number 0. And we can do the same thing for all the others. If we say virtual page number 1, that's the second entry in the array. It has a valid bit of 1, a kernel bit of 0, a virtual page number of this quantity, and so on. So we're going to have it stored in memory, but we can easily read out from that memory to figure out what the corresponding page table entry is. And in our operating system, we're just going to set this base register when we switch to a process to point to a page table we constructed for that process in memory earlier. Okay, some questions? Some mapping? Yeah.
Like the dash 1 or dash 3?
The question is, like, why do I have dash 1, dash 3? This is 10000 through 10001, and so on. I'm showing you 2 bytes at a time.
Okay.
That's what that's representing. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So this means now our memory access, we're going to start with our virtual address. We're going to split that up into our virtual page number and our page offset. We're going to take our virtual page number and we're going to multiply it by a page table entry size to figure out how many bytes into the array of page table entries do I want to go. And we're going to add that to the base address, and that's going to give us what is the starting byte of the page table entry I want to read, and we have to read it. And how do we read something from memory? Well, we ask the cache for it. So we're going to send that to the cache. It's going to send us back a page table entry. And from that, we're going to get the different pieces. So one thing we want to get is the physical page number. And in the common case, we're going to take that physical page number, combine it with our page offset from the original address, and then we're going to access memory at that location. So we're going to talk to the cache again. And now we actually have the value the program was looking for. But sometimes we're going to have to say that something's wrong. So we're also going to get the valid in the kernel bit off of that page table entry, check that, and just like before, possibly trigger an exception. So this is our procedure. And this is going to be something our hardware is going to do. And we're going to call the component of our processor, which does this, the memory management unit. Some questions about this procedure? OK. So something to note about what we just did here is now each cache access is two cache accesses, one to read the page table entry, another to actually do the read. And if we think about our processor, this means that each instruction can do up to four cache accesses, two to read the instruction and two to actually execute the instruction. This is pretty expensive. We mentioned about like really wanting to make our caches nice and fast. Yeah, take one cycle. Now I'm telling you, well, we're doing twice as many cache accesses. This is going to make that real challenging. And this is actually a problem. And so we're going to have a slightly different solution later on, but we're going to fix this being slow. But for now, we're doing something that, yeah, it's a bit slow. So, but it seems besides being slow, we've kind of solved the problem of our page tables being huge, but not really. So let me think about a modern system, so my desktop. My desktop has 39-bit physical addresses and 48-bit virtual addresses, and it still uses 4,096-byte pages. Okay. So one question, how many page table entries would there be in the scheme we just talked about? Someone tell me, what should I do to figure that out? So, yeah.
2 to the 36.
So you say 2 to the 36. How did you get that?
I think 4,096 is 2 to the 12.
Yes.
There's 48-bit virtual addresses, so 48 minus 12. 36.
Yeah, so you say 48-bit virtual addresses, so 12 bits are the page offset, which means that 36 bits are the page number, which means we have 2 to the 36 virtual pages. So we have 2 to the 36 entries, and we can do something similar to figure out how big are our virtual page number, our physical page numbers, and we learn that there are 27 bits. So you might say if we're storing in memory, we need to go to a whole number of bytes. So it's going to be, you know, 4 bytes per entry. But turns out that it's actually 8 bytes per entry. They have extra bits like the valid and the kernel mode bit that they want to store, and they want room for expansion, so they chose 8 bytes. All this, so they wanted a power of 2 because that makes the multiply times the page table entry size a lot faster. So if we figure out we have 2 to the 36 entries, each entry is 8 bytes, that's 2 to the 39 bytes, or half a terabyte. So my desktop does not have half a terabyte. So you can conclude from this that it does not store page table entries or page tables in this way. It does something different, and we're going to talk about that at some future date. So these are our two problems we had. So one is that it seems slow because we're accessing the cache a bunch, and the other is that when we're talking about these 64-bit systems, it seems like we're out of memory before we've even started the program. So we're going to have fixes for that later. And the preview of our fixes is the cache accesses we're going to fix with more caches. Just add extra caches. And for the page tables being really huge, we're going to use some not flat array data structure to store them. And we'll talk about exactly what that is later. But since we've introduced page tables, let's do a little exercise here. So here I have a physical memory contents where I'm showing you the value at address 0 is 00, the value at address 1 is hex 11, the value at address 2 is hex 22, and so on. And I'm saying we have 5-bit virtual addresses and 6-bit physical addresses, so here's a page table based on that with 8-byte pages. This means our pages are 8 bytes, so that's physical page 0 is there, 1, and so on. And in this case, I'm not storing the page table inside the memory, mainly to make this problem that I'm going to have in the next slide a little more convenient, not because we wouldn't actually do that. So given that, here are some virtual addresses. I recommend writing things down. Figure out what do these actually access? What is the value? If a program's reading from these addresses, what is it actually going to read? Okay, who needs more time? Someone tell me for 1-8, what's the first thing I should do? Yeah. Okay, so how do I do that? So, so this is the binary for the that first address, yeah. And so you've learned we have 2 to the 8-byte pages, which is, that's 2 to the 3. So we have 3-bit page offsets. So the last 3 bits is our page offset. Everything else is our virtual page number. So our virtual page number is 1-1. So that's the first thing we need to know. Then we look up 1-1 in our table. We find out that it corresponds to physical page 0. So to construct our final address, we're going to take that physical page 0 and combine it with the page offset from our original address and get an address of all zeros, which means we're going to read zeros from the address, physical address 0. So our result is 0. Yes? The question is, how did we, like the table on the left, that is given to us. This is something the operating system is going to set up. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so how about the next one? So I'm going to do the same procedure. So we have, we write it out in binary. So I have 0 and 0, 0, 1. That's the 5-bit virtual address. And we know the bottom 3 bits are our page offset. So the rest is our virtual page number. So it's virtual page 0, which maps to 0, 1, 0 is the physical page number. So I combine that with my page offset, and I get the actual physical address. And if I convert this back to hexadecimal, I learn that it's 1-3. So I look for 1-3, and I find out that it's right there. Which hopefully agrees with, yeah. Sure. Questions on how I did that? So, so then for our next example, we have 0, 1, 0, 1, 0 in binary. Again, we have 3-bit page offset in this case. So our virtual page number is this 0, 1. We go to here, find out it's physical page, all ones. So we take that physical page number, combine it with our page offset to get our final physical address. And we learn that that is 3A in hex, which is going to be right here. So when the program reads from that address, it gets OXDC based on that. Okay, how about 1-3? For virtual address 1-3, what happens? Yeah, a fault. So we're going to look this up, and we find out it's virtual page 1-0. We looked it up in here. There's a physical page number there, but it, the valid bit is not set, so it's not going to work. It's going to trigger a fault. So instead of actually the program reading a value, we're going to run the OS and ask the OS what to do. So any questions about anything in this exercise here? So let's talk about some other things we want our page tables to do that we're kind of missing support for. So one thing is we want to have a program like, say, our lab machines, where a system like our lab machines, where we have multiple copies of the same program running. So for example, a whole bunch of people might log into that machine and run Emacs. And it seems like it would be a real shame to not be able to take advantage of the fact that, well, if a whole bunch of people are running Emacs, do we really need to have multiple copies of Emacs's code loaded into memory? And it seems like page tables solve this problem for us. We can just have each of these processes have their own page table that have the same physical page numbers for that those virtual addresses. On all the programs, problem solved, we have one copy of Emacs loaded, we've saved a bunch of space, seems great. But this is not quite enough. And one way of thinking about this problem is what if MST3K is running Emacs and they find a nice bug in Emacs where Emacs does a out-of-bounds pointer access and accesses some memory it's not supposed to. Let's say maybe it tries to write to its code. That would be a problem because it would break the process abstraction. Remember, we wanted our processes to create the illusion that you own all of memory. But if we share memory like this, and MST3K's copy of Emacs here tries to write to this erroneously because they, you know, MST3K typed some command which is buggy, then now all of a sudden, XYZ's copy of Emacs starts breaking, even though they didn't do anything weird. That's not acceptable. So you want some way of preventing that. And our solution is we're going to add extra features to our page table so the operating system can do this sharing, but not have this be a problem. Not have this break that illusion that you're the only one accessing your memory, even though part of your memory is shared with someone else. And our solution is going to be that we're going to take that same idea we had with our kernel mode bit, and we're going to extend it to have more bits like that that we check based on what's going on with the access. So for example, there's multiple ways different architectures might do this. We could add a bit for saying whether you can execute things using this virtual page, whether you can write things using this virtual page, and possibly more. And how we're going to use this is when we do that translation, we're going to check those bits. And we're going to check it based on why are we accessing memory. So if I'm accessing memory because the program counter is there, because I'm reading an instruction, I'm going to check this executable bit. And if it's not set, I'm going to trigger an exception. If I'm accessing memory just to read it, I won't check that bit. If I'm accessing memory to write it, I'm going to check this writable bit. Otherwise, I'm not. And with this writable bit, we exactly solve that problem I talked about of what if one user triggers the bug that overwrites things? Well, now that's going to trigger an exception, and we're going to turn that bug into giving you an error message on the console rather than messing up the other user's copy of the program. And now the OS can safely share stuff between the two programs and not have any concerns about one user messing up another user's program, no matter how weirdly, you know, whatever weird bugs they find, or whatever. So questions on this idea of these, what we call permission bits? So I've talked about doing this for the case of I have two copies of Emacs running, and that might save a lot of space. And we could imagine on something like Portal, like that seems really useful. Like there's lots of people logging into that, probably lots of copies of whatever text editor people are using these days. That will actually save a lot of space. But there's a bigger case for using the same functionality, which saves even more space. Something we actually mentioned early in the semester, which was shared libraries. So we mentioned shared libraries. We have this idea that we have things like printf, fopen, and you know, all these functions that lots of programs use. And we talked about saving space on disk, that rather than have every executable have their own copy of printf, we can have the executable have a pointer to a copy of printf that's in some other file, and therefore not store, you know, 1,000 copies of printf on our disk. We just store one. We can do better than that. We can, in addition to only having one copy on disk, we can only have one copy in memory. We can only load the shared library once into memory, and everyone gets to use it. That one copy of printf. So even though we're running all sorts of different programs, if they all use printf, they all use the same memory for their copy of printf, we don't waste space for all the copies of printf they're using. So this is something we actually do, and it's a really nice advantage of being able to have these things shared read-only. It's also a bigger case for that concern about bugs I told you, because now we're not just concerned about Emacs is buggy, it will mess up another copy of Emacs. Now I'm concerned about that program you're writing for an assignment is buggy, it will mess up any program that's using printf. But we can prevent that with these permission bits and making sure things are read-only. And something which comes up when we're doing this is that we want to make sure we can load this copy of printf into different memory locations now, because we're loading into different programs, and we want to have exactly one copy in memory. So we can't really do the thing where we like edit a bunch of addresses in it efficiently. So a common thing that's done as part of supporting these shared libraries is something known as position-independent code that will make a version of printf that we can load to any place in memory and have it still work. And that means that that printf, if it's accessing a global variable, it's not going to access it by hard-coding the address. It's going to do something like where it does an offset from the address of its code or something like that. This is an extra step, but it's worth it because now it means we can have all these programs have the same thing in memory for this library, even if they have different amounts of code and different libraries. So it introduced sort of our basics of page tables. So we had our program addresses that were virtual, our real addresses that were physical. And our key idea is we divided all of memory, both the real and the virtual memory, the physical and the virtual memory, into fixed size pages. We always chose power of two sizes because it means that we can easily figure out what index page we have. We gave a page table entry for each page. We learned that we're going to store these typically in memory. In a page table, we'll have a pointer to the page table. That's what we're going to tell the processor about. The processor is going to use that pointer to actually look up the entry. And so far, we're saying we're going to have these bits we're going to check in there. So validity or permission, can you write, can you read, can you execute? And whenever something goes wrong there, we're going to trigger an exception. So this is what we have so far. So now we're going to start doing things which are a little less straightforward. I'm going to start by changing what we do here. So far it seems like we trigger an exception, and the only thing we've learned about that exception doing is like we just say, kill the program. That's what we've done so far. We say, oh, your copy of Emacs is buggy, it's writing to its code, we're killing it. Oh, we went out of bounds and tried to access, you know, the kernel memory, we're killing you, and so on. But there's other options. And this gives operating systems a lot of flexibility to do things which don't really seem like they make sense with the model of a processor we have before. The key idea is that the operating system has options other than crashing when we have a page fault. What we can do instead is it can change the page tables and then rerun that memory access, and this time it will work. And let's give an example of where that would be useful. So usually, you probably run program, write programs in C, and you're probably used to being able to do a lot of recursion safely, that you can have like a pretty deeply recursive function, like maybe thousands of call stacks deep. And often, that just works. And if we want to support that by default, that means we need to make our stack pretty big, right? We want to have, like, if you want to store support that recursive function that calls itself 10,000 times deep, then we need like a megabyte of stack or something like that, or maybe multiple megabytes. But a typical program probably doesn't use nearly that much stack space. Typical program, you know, maybe it's using like 12K. So we have this kind of bad choice that it seems like we'd like to support like these really deep recursive calls and just have every program start out with, you know, 8, 10, 8, 16, 100 megabytes of stack space, so your recursive code still works. But we don't want to waste space when most of the programs are like using 12K of that. And this is a problem real operating systems have, right? That we'd like to have not allocate a ton of space, except if we need it. If the program actually is like doing some big recursive call, we do want to allocate that space. So there's a solution to this, which is that we can take advantage of the fact that we get an exception to allocate this space only when it's needed. How will we know when it's needed? Well, we don't allocate it, and then when the program tries to use the space, it triggers an exception. And that's when we want to allocate it. So the way this might work is we're running some program. It's about to run instruction A here that pushes something to the stack. And the stack pointer happens to be at the very end of the stack. And right before it, where we're going to push, where we're about to push, is not valid yet. So the processor is going to run this memory access. It's going to determine, oh, that doesn't work. I'm going to trigger a page fault. And rather than our page fault handler saying, too bad, segmentation fault, our page fault handler is going to look up the address that triggered the page fault. So this is some hardware support we need. The hardware needs to tell the operating system, hey, this is the address the program is trying to access. So the operating system looks at that address and says, OK, what did I use set that aside for? And it figures out, oh, that's part of the stack of the program. I just haven't allocated it yet. So I'm just going to start allocate that right now. So once it figures out that this is not because the program went out of bounds, it's just because the program needs more stack space, it allocates that extra stack space, puts it in the page table, and then it returns from the exception. And that's going to retry the instruction. And to facilitate this, the processor is going to make it so that if you don't do anything and you return from a page fault, the default behavior is to redo the instruction that caused the page fault. So this means we just change the page table, return. Now it's going to try again, and this time it will work. And then the program just moves on and executes all those other instructions with, you know, and as far as the program's concerned, that push took a little bit of extra time, but it's just as if it already had that space allocated. Yes? So can I explain the difference between going out of bounds and running out of stack space? So the difference here is what does the OS do when the page fault happens? So in this case, if the OS decides that it's going to allocate the memory you went to, then you didn't go out of bounds, right? As far as the processor is concerned, it can't tell the difference. All it knows is, the OS didn't tell me what this means. I have to ask the OS to figure out what to do. Yes?
Can the OS allocate more stack space than just like that one entry? Because like, what if you just keep pushing and just have to keep allocating?
The question is, will the OSs that implement this kind of scheme allocate more than just one entry? That is an option. I don't know how common that is, but it's definitely an option. And it's a tricky trade-off. Like, How fast is this page fault handler versus how much space are you wasting? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. The question, when it allocates the new space, does it allocate a whole page? Yes. And it has to do that because the only thing we can tell the processor about is whole pages. You have to make a whole page table entry. There's no way of saying, here's a page table entry, but only the first half or the last half is valid. There's just not a way of representing that. Other questions? Okay. So I showed you this for stack space. And commonly, operating systems will use this for more than just the stack. They'll use it for how they load programs in general. Because this means that if not all of the program is loaded from disk, we don't need to wait to start executing the program. We just load it as we get it from the disk. And, you know, and in response to page faults, we can read more or wait for more to be read from disk. So the idea is we can start the program right away and have, like, if it's like a 10 meg program, well, it doesn't need 10 megabytes to just start. And we can load those 10 megabytes in the background while it's starting. So this is a very common thing real OSs do for not just the stack, which starts out empty, but for also for loading all sorts of things because it just makes things faster. And this means that if we're implementing this kind of scheme, then you know, loading the program is just create an empty page table. That's like we can get away with just doing that and just loading things in response to page faults. Like, probably we want to choose kind of an intermediate point where we load some stuff immediately, but we don't need to actually have the whole program available. And this is actually a big speed win even for like the code part of the program. And this is where I'm going to leave off today because to be synced with the other lecture. So first, any questions on this? Or I guess we're all set? Okay. See you next week.